Now, supersymmetric theories enjoy many constraints imposed by the supersymmetry, and for many theories, these constraints, which are essentially kinematic constraints, are enough to allow us to deduce the dynamics of the theory without actually directly solving the dynamics. And this involves a large web of known results that start from maybe one or two actual calculations of dynamics, limits, and these constraints to deduce all these interesting dynamics. So this has led to a explosion of results for supersymmetric theories over the last decade. In particular, for critical theories, we have examples in dimensions 2 through 6. Many of these have local order parameters. Some or many of these examples are exotic in that they don't have local order parameters, or they don't even have a Gaussian fixed point description. They only exist at strong coupling. Other examples in critical theories, supersymmetric critical theories, are confinement and fractionalization. There are many dualities. For example, there are particle monopole dion dualities. In some examples, particle vortex dualities. And there are also many instances of emergent phenomena, in particular global symmetries that aren't there at a Gaussian fixed point, but are only there at an interacting fixed point. Emergent gauge symmetries, and as we just heard, even emergent gravity. Now, these kinematic constraints that supersymmetry imposes on theories often come in the form of non-renormalization theorems. And these non-renormalization theorems lead to exact results for many quantities, and as we'll see today, some of them lead to exact results for critical exponents at fixed points. And they also are useful for many other things, such as state counting and checking many of the, in particular, duality Joe just talked about. So these are all interesting phenomena that have been discovered in supersymmetric theories, but why study supersymmetry in the context of condensed matter? Well, first, many of these just provide model systems that one might study in a very controlled situation to understand any of these phenomena. A second possibility is that one might actually hope to realize supersymmetry in a physical system in the laboratory. So I'll take one step towards answering this last question in the talk today. So how could supersymmetry be realized in a condensed matter system? Well, since the microscopic theory isn't supersymmetric, it can only be realized as an emergent phenomena in the infrared. That would occur if, for some values of parameters for some system, all the interactions which violate supersymmetry are irrelevant or tuned to zero. So in that case, the theory would flow in the infrared to be supersymmetric, and supersymmetry would be an emergent phenomena. Now, near a critical point, the renormalization group flows are very large, so those are the natural places to look for emergent phenomena. So in the rest of the talk, I'll focus on emergent supersymmetry at fixed points, and so it'll be a combination of supersymmetry and conformal symmetry, which turns out to form a bigger symmetry, superconformal symmetry. So here are the ingredients I'll use. Just to start, I won't try to tackle any emergent exotic critical point, supersymmetric critical point. So I'll assume that there's some local order parameter, as in a standard Wilson-Fischer fixed point. Now, if supersymmetry is going to be an emergent phenomena that's realized in the infrared, then the matter content of the theory, the relevant matter content, has to form some representation of the superalgebra. So if there's a local bosonic order parameter, it has to have a superpartner, a fermionic order parameter, since supersymmetry transforms bosons into fermions. So that's a necessary requirement. Second, if I'm at a critical point, then there should be a second order phase transition, at which point the dispersion relation for the boson is linear. And since my goal is to realize space-time supersymmetry, so the anticommutator of the supercharges closes to translations in both the time and the space direction, not, for example, just in the time direction, then in the infrared, the dispersion relation for the fermion should also be linear, i.e. relativistic, with the same speed of sound. So I'll just make these assumptions. This would, of course, be one assumption you'd want to relax and see how the results I'll show you are modified for that. But for this talk, I'll just take the first step and make these assumptions. Now, if thermal fluctuations are important near a critical point, i.e. the critical point is controlled by thermal fluctuations, well, if thermal fluctuations are important, then Bose and Fermi occupation numbers are different at finite temperature, or equivalently the thermal circle in the Euclidean path integral, finite temperature path integral, the boundary conditions for bosons and fermions are different, so it explicitly breaks supersymmetry. So thermal fixed points are not good candidates to look for emergent supersymmetry. However, if rather than thermal fluctuations, it's quantum fluctuations that are important near a fixed point at zero temperature, well then all the occupation numbers can be the same, and with these assumptions, the Bose and Fermi quantum fluctuations of this supersymmetric order parameter would also be the same. So quantum critical points are the natural candidates to look for emergent supersymmetry at zero temperature. The final ingredient that I'll assume is the most general set of interactions for some given order parameter. I'll do two examples, possibly restricted by global symmetries to simplify the problem. Now, all of these ingredients are satisfied in two dimensions. There's a whole infinite family of known supersymmetric critical points. The tricritical Ising model is the simplest, and there's a whole infinite tower. Supersymmetry exists in these systems really because bosons and fermions are not that different in two dimensions. The superconformal algebra is infinite dimensional, and there's lots of special things about two dimensions. So one could ask, and they're already classified, so one could ask an analogous question with all these ingredients I've listed in three dimensions and ask if there are supersymmetric critical points. That was in my list. We know of lots of supersymmetric critical points in three dimensions in particular. And then the question would be, could one of those be realized as an emergent phenomenon given these list of ingredients? So let's start with the simplest possibility. So, as I said, I have to have an order parameter which has both a boson and a fermion. And the simplest bosonic order parameter I can imagine is just a single real order parameter. So this would be a generalization of the standard Wilson-Fisher fixed point. And my goal is to study three dimensions. Now, under supersymmetry, a real scalar field transforms into a real two-component Weyl spinner. And so if I have any chance of the system realizing supersymmetry with some massless fermions with linear dispersion relation, this is precisely how many I need, just one real two-component Weyl fermion if there's a single real order parameter. So at least the matter content forms a representation of supersymmetry. The interactions may or may not, but at least there's a chance. So now I can write in an expansion in dimension of operators the most general Lagrangian up to two derivatives for both the boson and the fermion. And in the regularization I'll show you in the next slide, all the higher order terms are irrelevant. So these are all the relevant or marginal terms plus irrelevant terms. Now, in this list, there are two relevant operators. There's a mass for the fermion and a mass for the boson. So in particular, this would be the most general theory that would realize this would be a multi-critical point. You would have to tune two parameters, namely the mass for both the boson and the fermion, to zero. However, it might be that in a system that realizes this, the fermion might be massless everywhere in some phase. For example, if it arose as a node in the Fermi surface, that would happen everywhere in a phase and wouldn't require any additional tuning. So in that case, it would be just a standard critical point with only one parameter to tune to get to the critical point, not a multi-critical point. Now, at mean field, this most general interactions I've written for this order parameter just has the same phase diagram as the the non-supersymmetric analog. Now, for these couplings here, there's a special line in the coupling constant space on which supersymmetry is realized in the interactions, and that is where the Yukawa coupling of the scalar to the fermions is equal to the quartic interaction of the scalar up to appropriate normalizations. And, of course, when the mass of the two fields is equal. So on this subspace of these couplings, there's an enhanced symmetry. It's a supersymmetry. It's a transformation between the boson and the fermion field. So here's the transformation. This supersymmetry can be made manifest on the subspace by rewriting the theory in a superspace. So that's done by extending the usual space-time coordinates to include a fermionic coordinate. And then one writes fields on the superspace, which, because of the Grassmann properties of the fermionic coordinate, can always be written as a Taylor expansion of this type. And supersymmetry acts as translations on the superspace. And so that's, in fact, why it's related to it closes the square of a supersymmetry transformation. So two translations in the fermionic directions close to a translation in the usual spatial directions. And in the superspace notation that makes the supersymmetry manifest, the interactions, now since the couplings are equal, turn out can be written as an integral over the superspace of some function called the superpotential, which is a function of the superfields. And it won't be important in details, but just that there is some form on the superspace on which a supersymmetry is manifest. So I'll use that later. Oh, and F, okay, good. So there is a propagating scalar and a propagating fermion. And those form a representation for propagating modes. However, off-shell, the number of degrees of freedom don't match. And so if you want an off-shell field representation, then there has to be added an additional scalar degree of freedom, because there are two real components in the fermion. So there's one real component here and this F component. And it turns out that if you just introduce that and then ask what the interactions of F are, they don't have derivative interactions. So it's an auxiliary field. And we'll use that later also. So you're free, see, in components. So here in this form, I've integrated out the auxiliary field. And you could write it in a manifestly supersymmetric way in where you integrated it back in. OK, so that's the general theory. That's the simplest candidate. And now we can just ask what happens under a normalization group flow to the on the massless subspace to the couplings. Now, since you're interested in emergent supersymmetry, you want to be careful and regulate the theory in a way which has a chance to be supersymmetric. And I'll leave out the details, but what one does is, even though I'm interested in three dimensions, momentum integrations are convergent the operators become, the leading operators become marginal on the massless subspace in four dimensions. So it's useful to start the momentum integration in four dimensions and then do an epsilon expansion to get down to three dimensions. And there's a way to do this which preserves the Bose-Fermi symmetry, and it's motivated by looking at the supersymmetric theory, which in terms of supergraphs can be done completely bosonically, and then you're just left with a momentum integral that you're free to try to evaluate any way you can. And you can try to evaluate that momentum integral for the beta functions for the couplings by starting in 4 and extending as best you can down to 3. And so that's what I'll do. So at one loop, here are the beta functions for the Yukawa coupling and the self-interaction of the scalar. They have 4 fixed points. There's the free Gaussian fixed point. Along the axis in which the Yukawa coupling vanishes, it's just a Wilson-Fisher fixed point theory with decoupled fermions, so there's a Wilson-Fisher fixed point. It turns out there's also, if one turns off the self-interaction of the scalar, there's also a fixed point where the Yukawa coupling is non-zero, so that I'll call that the Yukawa fixed point. And the final fixed point is on the supersymmetric line, and it turns out that the Wilson-Fisher fixed point and the Yukawa fixed point are unstable. The instability of the Yukawa fixed point is, it wasn't guaranteed that would happen, but there's an important term here that comes from integrating out a box of a fermion with four scalars. Since that's a fermion, it contributes with the opposite sign, and that's crucial in making the supersymmetric fixed point attractive. So at leading order in epsilon, and in fact one could show then to every order in epsilon, the supersymmetric fixed point remains attractive, and the other ones remain unstable. So on the subspace of this theory, the massless subspace, there's an emergent superconformal symmetry, or equivalently for this system, conformal symmetry, stable conformal symmetry, namely the system sits at that point, implies an accidental additional symmetry, which is the superconformal symmetry. So such a toy system shows the phenomena of emergent supersymmetry. Yes, I'll talk about the exponents now. So certainly in a condensed matter system, one thing you would want is to look at the critical exponents. So in the scaling regime, there's two independent critical exponents. One describes the scaling of the Green's function for the order parameter in the scaling regime. The other describes the scaling of the correlation length. And then a final one, which I'll include, which will be interesting later, is the approach or the deviations from scaling or approach to the scaling regime. And that characterizes essentially the importance of the most relevant, irrelevant operators, namely the ones that flow towards the fixed point. And just for simplicity, I'm going to focus on the one that flows along the supersymmetric line. You could look at the other orthogonal one also. There would be an additional critical exponent for that. So at first order in epsilon, from the one-loop beta functions that I wrote in a previous slide, one can calculate then in the epsilon expansion the critical exponents. And so here they are for this theory at order epsilon, and I've compared them with the non-supersymmetric Wilson-Fisher exponents. The exponent eta is the one that characterizes the renormalization of the scalar field. In the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, this arises only at two loops, so it gets a leading contribution at order epsilon squared. But for the supersymmetric fixed point, the scalar can couple at one loop, gets quantum corrections to the propagation at one loop from the fermions, and so it does get a contribution at leading order in epsilon. The fact that the approach to scaling exponent goes like epsilon is just a remnant of the epsilon expansion. That's true for any theory that has a power series expansion in coupling. So there's no significance that these are the same. And the main thing just to draw from this is that there are some critical exponents one could calculate in an epsilon expansion, and they're different from the Wilson-Fisher critical exponents. Now let me generalize this to the next most complicated system one could consider.
Can one make the expansion from...
I'll do that right now, yeah. So the next most complicated thing one could imagine is not one real bosonic order parameter, but two real bosonic order parameters that are organized into a single complex bosonic field. In that case, since it's essentially two real fields, then the number of fermions I need in order to have a realization of supersymmetry is just two copies of the previous example. So this would be referred to as n equals 2. N in any dimension refers to the number of copies of the minimal supersymmetry. So the previous example we did was the minimal supersymmetry in three dimensions. So this would be n equals 2 supersymmetry in three dimensions. And that would be the requirement that you had a system with that matter content. Now for simplicity, I'll write down the most general couplings with a U1 global symmetry, and I'll choose the U1 global symmetry to be the most general one that allows the Yukawa coupling. Because if there's no Yukawa coupling between the scalar and the fermion, then there's no hope for the theory to be supersymmetric, or the interactions to be supersymmetric. So whatever the U1 symmetry is, I'll assume that the Yukawa coupling is allowed. And with that, then, this is the most general set of relevant and marginal interactions. The dots are irrelevant interactions, marginal or relevant in four dimensions. Now, this spinner actually exists in four dimensions. It's just a minimal vial spinner in four dimensions. And so one literally could start this theory in four dimensions. Think of it living in four dimensions and extending it to three dimensions, not just as a trick doing the momentum integrations. Now, the interesting thing is that with this U1 symmetry, there's only one relevant operator, namely the mass term for the scalar. The mass term for the fermion is disallowed by this U1 symmetry. And this set of operators, the full U1 symmetry is not required to get this structure. You could have discrete symmetries, or for example, the fermion, again, could just be massless in some entire phase. So there's a large number of different discrete symmetries one could pick, and if you don't pick a big enough one, you might get certain additional interactions that you'd have to consider. But for simplicity, we'll just look at this one in the interest of time. Now again, on the line lambda equals h, when the scalar is massless, the theory is supersymmetric. It has a super transformation between the boson and the fermion, just like the last one, and there's also a superspace realization where that's all manifest. And in addition, the interactions on the supersymmetric line can, again, be written as an integral over superspace of a superpotential. So now one regulates the theory by starting in four dimensions. Now, since the spinners live in four dimensions, this regularization has a name. It's called dimensional reduction. You keep the spinners in four dimensions so that you have the same number of them as you have bosons. So that sounds, that's certainly a good start to have a regulator that's supersymmetric. And again, the regulator is motivated by looking at the bosonic supergraphs. And this is widely believed to be a good supersymmetric regulator. So at one loop, one can calculate the beta functions, and they have qualitatively the same form. A few numbers are different. We'll comment on that later. I won't show the RG flow again. It's the same thing. So now, on this single subspace where the scalar mass vanishes, there's an emergent superconformal symmetry. The U1 symmetry now becomes the U1R symmetry of this supersymmetric theory. It turns out superconformal theories with this much supersymmetry necessarily have an R symmetry. I won't show that argument, but that's what that original symmetry was. It becomes the R symmetry at the superconformal point. It's just a U1 symmetry, and R is just because it's a letter in the middle of the alphabet. It doesn't mean anything. Yes. Yes. Well, remember, my ingredients was yes. I think that's written on the slide. Yeah. That's right. It's an accidental symmetry. Yeah, there it is. So conformal symmetry implies that there's an additional symmetry that's not there in the ultraviolet. It's just an accident of where the theory flows to in the infrared. Absolutely, yes. Yep. That's right.
Is the only way you can get the non-propagating fields by going to the infrared, and they play your role in spectroscopically?
Well, they're there in the sense that the non-propagating fields are the ones that couple the... So you can think of two scalars coupling to a non-propagating field and then coupling to two scalars again. Of course, you'd be free to integrate that in at any point on the coupling constant plane. It's just that it's
emerges in the infrared. It's not something that can start with.
Well, you can start with it there. I mean, I could have rewritten the interactions like that. It's just that the normalization of the fields and so forth wouldn't have special relations to other things in the theory except at the supersymmetric point. Now, I said the beta functions for this theory have the same general qualitative form as the previous ones, but there's actually some very special features of those. And to explain what those are, let me first remind you what the beta function looks like just for general coupling in any theory. So if you have some coupling multiplying some operator, which is a product of fields, then the beta function for that coupling gets three contributions. It has a classical scaling piece, it has a piece due to wave function, quantum wave function renormalization, and a piece due to quantum vertex renormalization. Now the classical scaling piece and the wave function piece necessarily are homogeneous in the coupling, because the coupling appears in the scaling. The vertex corrections, though, can be, in general, nonlinear functions of the couplings of the theory. Now, in any dimensional regularization scheme like the ones I'm using, the anomalous dimensions for fields or operators are independent of epsilon. They depend only on the couplings in the theory. And that's because the infinite renormalizations can be gotten from the 1 over epsilon poles in the counter terms. And since it's purely the 1 over epsilon poles, there can't be any additional epsilon dependence. No matter how many loops you go to, it can only depend on the couplings of the theory. So at a conformal point, epsilon appears only linearly in the beta function explicitly. But at the conformal point, that determines the couplings, but only in terms of some nonlinear function in general because of the vertex corrections. And so to invert this relation for general epsilon, you can do that by making a power series expansion in the coupling. And then the anomalous dimensions are a power series in epsilon. But it's because you had to do this, invert this nonlinear function. It's not because of an intrinsic feature of the beta function. The beta function explicitly only has an epsilon in it. So now let's return to the theory. We're looking at n equals 2 supersymmetry in three dimensions. This theory enjoys, because of the fact that it's n equals 2 supersymmetry, a non-renormalization theorem, which I'll just state. And it states that the superpotential, which all the interactions in the theory can be organized into this object, the superpotential, that object receives no vertex corrections. So it receives, in general, classical scaling corrections and wave function corrections, but it receives no vertex corrections. So that's interesting. That means then that the beta function for a superpotential coupling has this form. It has no vertex corrections.
Why is that?
Well, you can show, it can be shown at any order in perturbation theory by looking at supergraphs. You can see that the form of the superpotential, if you try to start drawing supergraphs, just doesn't match up to generate vertex corrections. It can generate wave function corrections, but not vertex corrections. So that's the graphs just don't exist. Just the way the arrows flow in the superspace. There's much more powerful ways to show it. You can, by using background symmetries, so you can assign charges to the couplings of the theory by imagining that they're background fields. I'll do that in a second for a specific example. So that restricts, in any theory, the form of the full quantum corrections, because whatever they are, they have to be invariant under the background, general background symmetries. What's really important for the superpotential, though, it has one more property. In order that the theory be supersymmetric, it's actually holomorphic. And so the combination of holomorphy plus background symmetries turns out to be very powerful in restricting the theory. And for actually this theory I'm showing you here, you can show that the statement of the non-renormalization theorem is actually exact, even non-perturbatively. It's not even an all-orders result. Okay. Now, this non-renormalization of the superpotential is very hard to see in components. So if I just handed you those beta functions, the previous slide, you would be hard-pressed to notice this non-renormalization theorem. And the reason is because of this auxiliary field. So in fact, here, this quartic interaction of the scalars actually includes both a superpotential term, which is not renormalized, plus a wave function renormalization for the auxiliary component. And that's related by supersymmetry to the wave function renormalization for the scalar and the fermion. And that's actually where the all the renormalization lies. So if you just wrote it in components, it wouldn't look like there aren't vertex corrections. In components, there are vertex corrections. So this feature is only really manifest when you look in superspace. So the important feature is, because there aren't vertex corrections, the beta function is homogeneous in the coupling. And therefore, at the fixed point, the anomalous dimension for the field is fixed entirely in terms of epsilon, and that's an exact statement in epsilon, and it relies only on the fact that there's no vertex corrections. So the critical exponent eta, which is the renormalization of the field, is exact. The epsilon expansion for this critical exponent is exact at order epsilon, and it has no corrections in this theory at the superconformal point. It's also possible to show this feature from this from the superconformal algebra, but in the interest of time, I won't do that.
So you can plug in epsilon equals
1, 2, whatever you like. For 2, it's also it's the right answer. Yeah. So that was that critical exponent. Since I'm out of time, you could ask, what about the second critical exponent? That critical exponent is related to the renormalization of the mass operator for the scalar. But that operator explicitly violates supersymmetry, so you might not think you can make any exact statements for that. However, I won't go through the argument. You can look at the slides online if you're interested. It turns out by writing the beta function, extending the beta function equations into superspace, and writing background fields that include the wave function, one can, by a trick, notice that this wave function factor, the highest component in superspace, actually is the soft mass term. So by looking at the beta function equations in superspace, it turns out you can deduce even what this even what the renormalization of this non-supersymmetric operator is in this theory. It's related to something you don't know exactly, but it is, turns out, it's exactly related to the critical exponent omega. So it just depends on the approach to the critical point. And so there's an exact relation between omega and nu. And so now if I finish with my table, critical exponents, for twice minimal supersymmetry, one critical exponent is exact at order epsilon. Nu, you can't calculate exactly, but there is an exact relation between nu and omega. So supersymmetry enforces some relations. Well, I'll just mention that one thing one might worry is that any time you have a order parameter that's coupled to other fields, fluctuations of the other fields could, in principle, induce a first-order phase transition. So the quantum fluctuations could ruin the first-order phase transition. And one can go through a series of arguments by looking at the beta functions plus these exact results and demonstrate that that's not the case. So these quantum critical points are stable against fluctuations, quantum fluctuations. One could ask about generalizations. One could try to break the R symmetry, violate Lorentz invariance, try multi-component systems, look at examples with even more supersymmetry. Those now require gauge fields. And the general feature one gets, at least by adding more and more supersymmetry, is it's not true that any theory you write down, everything always flows back to the supersymmetric point. However, it does turn out to be true that on large regions of the space, the theory does flow to be supersymmetric, and it doesn't cross the supersymmetric boundary. So large regions of the parameter space will flow to a supersymmetric point. There's an unstable direction coming out of the supersymmetric point, but if you start on the right side, since you can never go through the critical point, you never go past the deep infrared, you still get emergent supersymmetry. In general models, this question of whether there can be a fluctuation-induced first-order phase transition is more delicate. In simple models, you still can demonstrate that you retain the second-order phase transition, but in some cases, you do get a first-order fluctuation that destroys the critical point. Just to summarize, you can have emergent superconformal symmetry. It's possible in very simple three-dimensional systems. It's possible to even just have a single relevant direction. These examples are stable. They provide new examples of quantum supercritical points. And with enough supersymmetry, there are exact relations among the critical exponents. And for lessons, well, one could go off and try to find systems that satisfy these criteria. More general lessons is that for these exact results in particular, supersymmetry was sufficient, but it wasn't necessary. There were certain necessary conditions to get some of these exact relations. And if you had a system that, even a non-supersymmetric system that satisfied those, you would get exact relations. So I have no doubt that there are at least a few non-supersymmetric systems in which there are analogous exact results for things like critical exponents. Stop there. Oh, I'm sure, yes. If you, in fact, the only ingredient would be just getting the matter content correct, probably, if you could.
Lattice itself is calcium.
No, I wouldn't think so. In fact, I would think it would be easy. It would just be getting the matter content right. That would be the hard part, yeah.
Okay. In models, we more or less believe the solution of one never changes the number of either global or if there any local conservation law on that. But of course, lots of things that people are trying can be couched in terms of emergent new conservation laws, and that's where, in some sense, there is a lot of disagreement whether such things are possible. In the kind of thing that you are describing, are there emergent new conservation laws?
Yeah, there are conserved supercharges, yeah. But I would say that I would make the following analogy. For example, the O2 Heisenberg model with a interaction that breaks the O2 symmetry, is that interaction is irrelevant. It's marginally irrelevant in the infrared. So there's a symmetry in the infrared, namely the full O2 symmetry. In the ultraviolet, there's only a Z2 symmetry. So, I mean, this is just a more complicated version of that.
That's something we're used to.
I think it's common to have enhanced symmetries at a fixed point.
Yes, Scott, I wanted to ask you if I just want to see if I got it right. For your second model, you had the fermion with two components, and there were two nodes or one node?
Well, that would be two. That would be two complex vial fermions.
That's two.
Well, you have to tell me what a node counts as. I think that's two nodes.
Do I count that as spin up, spin down, both with two nodes, or spin up, spin down with one node?
I think the latter. Spin up, spin down at one node.
Okay.
For the second model, I imposed the U1 symmetry or some discrete symmetries to forbid some terms. Yes. In particular, the fermion mass. Yeah. Now, if you didn't do that and you had a fermion mass, then it just becomes a multi-critical point. You just have to tune more than one thing. But there's still U1 symmetry that acts on the fermion. But well, I think calling it a chiral symmetry is a misnomer. I mean, in even dimensions, it's That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Might support such a thing. It seems to me that your assumption of the Lorentz invariance on the fermion dispersion is going to throw out a lot of possibilities. That seems like a really.
I think that's the biggest assumption. Yeah. And so I think one thing that should be checked is that that should be something that should be relaxed, and then see if that if the Lorentz symmetry emerges. I'm told there are systems like that. So.
Well, most of the time we often have Fermi surfaces.
The question would be whether your node would point to the anisotropy, which would be KX.
That's right. And the sound velocity wouldn't have to be the same as the boson velocity either. So.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then let's thank the speakers again and break for our lunch.